You're listening to Beyond the Headlines, a production of the International Peace Institute, an independent think tank dedicated to the prevention and settlement of conflict. Coming up, Tanasis Kambanis, author of the book A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. Enjoy the program.
Good evening. I'm Warren Hoag, IPI's Vice President for External Relations, and I'm happy to welcome you here tonight for this Beyond the Headlines event featuring Tanasis Kambanis, author of the new book, A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. Just this past week, as you know, Hezbollah showed its muscle by toppling the government of Lebanon. The next day, Tanasis wrote an op-ed page piece in the New York Times that said the action, quote, signaled the final stage in Hezbollah's rise from resistance group to ruling power. Now, the current threat to Lebanese stability stems from sealed indictments filed yesterday by the prosecutor of a United Nations-backed tribunal that are expected to name members of Hezbollah as organizers and perpetrators of the 2005 car bomb assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. Hassan Nasrallah, the charismatic leader of Hezbollah, has sought to preempt the effect of those indictments by charging that the tribunal has become a tool of the Americans and Israelis. As Tanasi has written, Nasrallah cannot afford the blow to Hezbollah's popular legitimacy that would occur if it is thought to have been behind the Hariri killing. So a week ago today, Hezbollah used its power in the government, 10 of the cabinet's 30 ministerial seats, to bring the government down. At a moment, by the way, when the current prime minister, Saad Hariri, the son of the slain leader, was in Washington meeting with President Obama. Even for the volatile and lethal politics of Lebanon, this situation is particularly fraught. Saad Hariri is now faced with either caving into Hezbollah's demand that he disown and cease paying for the carefully conducted international investigation of his own father's killing, or trying to beat the odds and continue in office. Hezbollah has already brought Lebanon to the brink of civil war in 2008, and in 2006, of course, it fought a war against Israel that convulsed the entire southern half of the country. Tanasi was there for that war as a reporter for the Boston Globe, and he took some substantial risks hanging out with Hezbollah fighters under fire in targeted border areas. That's where the book begins, and it would be a good book even if it didn't go beyond that, because Tanasi is an acute observer and a very evocative writer. But he turns his book into a really compelling and meaningful one by combining this vivid personal reporting and its portraits of individual fighters with scholarly accounts of the history and origins and persistence of Islamic militancy. Despite the destruction caused in 2006, and despite calls on Hezbollah at the UN and elsewhere to disarm, it has instead rearmed. It's helped to repopulate the South and build its fighting forces back up in a campaign marketed as, quote, better than before. It is, by all estimates, considerably more powerful now than before that war in 2006. Now, much of this is due to heavy financing from Iran, and you will recall that Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad went to one of the resurrected border towns this fall and taunted the Israelis across the frontier. Now, most people keen to see peace in the Middle East favor the two-state solution, Israel and Palestine, but Hezbollah is dead set against it because that would preserve the state of Israel. I was in Beirut and South Lebanon in the immediate aftermath of the 2006 war, touring the area as a New York Times reporter covering Secretary General Kofi Annan as he sought to end the Israeli blockade of the country. The South was virtually deserted at that point, with many villages and the southern suburbs of Beirut that Hezbollah controlled in ruins, and all the roads up to Beirut bombed out and impassable. but pointedly at almost every entrance to a village or beside rubble from the Beirut high-rises that had been flattened by Israeli warplanes, or at bends in the road in the rural south, there were banners flapping in the wind showing the fiercely bearded Hassan Nasrallah claiming, quote, divine victory, unquote. Tanasi returned to Lebanon this fall, and in October he wrote a piece in the New York Times chronicling the rebuilding of the area and the reinforcement of arms. Citing just one figure from that story, where Hezbollah had 13,000 missiles before the war, it now has 40,000, he wrote. The title of Tanasi's book comes from a Lebanese man who spoke to him while he was reporting the war and said, quote, it would be a privilege to die for Hassan Nasrallah. I read the book on a flight back from a conference in November in Abu Dhabi, co-hosted by IPI and the United Arab Emirates, that attracted more than 20 foreign ministers, the entire Palestinian leadership, Tony Blair in his role as representative of the quartet, and a number of very well-known specialists, many of whom are potential peacemakers in the region. It was all off the record, but I can tell you that I returned to New York after that with the possibilities of Middle East peace anytime soon looking very, very slim. Some of you know that this evening is the third date we have had for Tanasi's appearance, and I fear this morning there might be a fourth one. The third date, December 1st and January 12th, having fallen victim to bad weather. So I've had to compose this introduction three times. And with each version, I've had to acknowledge that even in that short time, Hezbollah's power has grown and the possibility of peace and stability in the Middle East has become even more remote. So on that happy note, Tanasi, welcome finally to IPI. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Warren. I actually figured after a while that you were just going to wait until there was a war for us to have this, because I've been predicting war, you know, next summer for I think the last 2 years or 3 years. So now I'm saying, you know, summer 2011. I thought you would just kick the date back to June and then we would, you know, have a capacity crowd. But thank you all for braving the weather and the cancellations to come out tonight and hear us talk about why Hezbollah has become such a powerful, staying, and dynamic force in the Middle East. Now, when we follow Hezbollah from here, we're usually looking at the leader of the group who really symbolizes and represents Hezbollah for us, Hassan Nasrallah, the sort of unflappable Pillsbury doughboy with a beard and a turban who gives hour-long speeches seemingly every other day. And he's been leading Hezbollah since 1992. He has come to be the face of this party for the West and for Israel. And in no way do I want to diminish his importance and his centrality to the ascent and the enduring power of Hezbollah. But when we look at the event of last week and we see Hassan Nasrallah ordering his ministers to withdraw from the government, toppling the government, and then leisurely waiting a few days to appear on TV and explain why Hezbollah decided to do this. And he just sits there with a little enigmatic smile and gives a lesson, a clinic, and tells a few jokes while he's at it. And he spends an hour telling his audience, which is on the edge of its seat, why Hezbollah has decided to do what it's done. And everyone's waiting. I mean, for days before, what's he going to say? And for days after, what did it mean? My question has always been, how the hell did this guy get to be so important? Why do people care so much what he says? And the first step towards that answer is understanding that unlike any leader in the Middle East, he's got legions of followers, in his case a million or more, who believe everything he says, who are willing to die for him, but also, more important than willing to die for him, are willing to live for him and do what he asks them to. And second of all, this community and the people who hate him and oppose him trust everything he says. When he says we are not going to stop until, let's say in this case, until Lebanon withdraws its support for the tribunal prosecuting Hariri, we're not going to stop until Everyone recognizes that that tribunal is an Israeli and American tool. That sounds rhetorical to us. Everyone involved realizes those are Hezbollah's demands, and they are going to deploy any tool in their arsenal to meet those to achieve those goals. So, my voyage as a reporter was from a starting point, and this is a starting point 4 years ago, or 5 years ago now, when Hezbollah wasn't nearly as dominant as it is today. But even then, everyone around the region was holding up Hezbollah as a model. I mean, Muqtada Sadr's followers in Iraq were telling me they aspired to be like Hezbollah. Hamas activists in Gaza were telling me the same thing. Muslim Brothers in Jordan, on and on. Everyone was saying, oh, we want to copy Hezbollah's approach. So by the time I got to Lebanon, I wanted to know what this approach was, why people thought it was so worth emulating, and really what was motivating the rank and file inside Hezbollah. So I began my search for the meaning and significance of Hezbollah, not in the speeches of Nasrallah or in the stated policies of the group, but rather in and among the soccer moms and the weekend warriors, the fighters and the troop leaders of Hezbollah's Society of Islamic Resistance. And for me, that was really the question that would allow me to one, understand them, and two, distinguish them from the much less successful movements that I'd covered all around the region. I first looked for Hezbollah during the 2006 war, and I sort of hailed a taxi from Damascus, rode down to Beirut, and my game plan was to just get as close to the Israeli border as possible and look for people with beards and cargo pants. and you know that was really my entire blueprint. No one in Lebanon wanted to join me in this because they thought it was a completely suicidal approach. So I ended up getting my own rental car, lying, saying I wouldn't take it out of Beirut, and I drove down to the border, and you know spent a couple of fruitless days going up to these guys in mosques with beards and cargo pants and saying, hey, are you in Hezbollah? And them sort of saying, you know, we're not interested in talking to reporters, you know, be on your way. But halfway through the war, a brief truce was declared, and we went to the village of Bin Jabal. Now, that's the border town that Warren referred to, where Mahmoud Ahmadinejad gave his triumphal speech just this past fall. And this is a village that really represents the apotheosis of Hezbollah's successful project with its own community. This is a town where you're hard-pressed to find a neutral party. It's been destroyed in every one of the wars between Hezbollah and Lebanon. It's a place where if you're Lebanese and you've chosen to stay in Bin Jabal, you're likely to either be an active member of Hezbollah or a passive but passionate supporter. And this town had already been, and for Israel, by the way, this town really stuck in their craw, and the head of the army and some Israelis argue really screwed up Israel's strategy by focusing too much on trying to take this symbolic town rather than on doing what would be militarily more effective to control the south. But anyway, this town for both sides became this symbol of Hezbollah's persistence, Hezbollah's willingness to see its infrastructure destroyed and keep on coming back to fight again. And at this point, halfway through the war, the village was already more destroyed than anything I'd seen in my life, anything I'd seen in Iraq or in the Balkans. It was, you know, it was apocalyptic. The downtown area was just a sea of rubble with slightly shallower alleys of rubble to mark the streets. And we wandered through looking for people from Hezbollah. And finally, sort of like a vision, this guy appears from beneath two piles of rubble and strides towards us with dust